Well, thank you, Stephen. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. The green light is on, so can everybody hear me? Okay, I see some. Okay, good, good. So, this is perhaps a slightly different topic from the usual colloquia, which I come to actually quite often, by the way. I enjoy the physics colloquia. Sometimes I don't understand all the technical details of that go here, but, you know, I try. So when we talk about Shakespeare and science, I mean, perhaps it's not a total shock that I'm, you know, attempting to bring these two fields together, but there are some kind of obstacles that present themselves. One of them is that, you know, when we use the word science, well, we always have to be very careful, right? Because what we think of as science today is not at all like what it was back then. And in fact, of course, there wasn't really a thing, I mean, there wasn't a thing to point to back then that you would recognize as science. And not only that, the sort of belief systems that were in the air were quite different from today. I mean, not that they've disappeared, but there were a lot of things that we would definitely put in the category of not really science. Astrology and witchcraft, for example, magic of various kinds. Those of you who do know your Renaissance literature will, the lower left picture is the frontispiece from Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe, one of Shakespeare's friends and colleagues. So there was sort of a different way of seeing the world. But then having said that, there were a lot of people sort of investigating nature. There were people doing astronomy and something like medicine, mathematics, definitely. So a lot of things that actually we do sort of recognize as part of today's scientific way of seeing the world were sort of coming into being. This is ye old timeline, and of course the history of science people will, this will all look very, very familiar. I'm going to mostly talk about this period from Copernicus's groundbreaking work to Galileo's Sidereus Nuncius. This isn't, of course, this is sort of the first two-thirds of the scientific revolution because, of course, Isaac Newton is off the timeline to the lower right. So there were a lot of interesting things going on, and then we might ask, I couldn't squeeze everything onto the timeline. I had to leave out a lot of stuff, but this was a big year. This was also Vesalius's textbook on human anatomy too, right? So not just Copernicus. And then we look at Shakespeare's life, and sure enough, he's around when these things are happening. Well, he's a child for this first little bit, and then he's an adult for that later part. But it still raises the question of whether he was interested in some of these developments, and if he was, you know, how interested, and did it affect his work? So I was talking about worldviews, and we might think of this traditional, very, very ancient idea associated with names like Aristotle and Ptolemy, this idea of a geocentric or earth-centered universe. I guess it's even harder if you have to carry the whole thing on your back, but yeah, it seems to be pulling it off okay. If you check out the close-up, you can certainly see we've got the four elements here. Earth, here's water, air, and fire. So you've got these traditional four elements, and then the planets imagined to be on these crystalline spheres that encircle the Earth, and then towards the outer limit, you've got the fixed stars. But Copernicus had already published his book, putting the sun at the center and sort of lifting the Earth into the heavens. I suppose, well, to the extent that it was radical or not radical, I suppose the most radical thing is that it sets the Earth in motion. Now the Earth is kind of flying through space, and that was an idea that a lot of people kind of found preposterous, which is explained some of the opposition to it. Now that was published 21 years before Shakespeare was born, but on the other hand, word was only sort of just starting to get out. The other thing we have to mention is that different artists and writers, you know, responded very differently. And for example, in Paradise Lost, well, we have to remember, of course, this Milton was working a full half century after Shakespeare. They were not contemporaries. But in Paradise Lost, you know, there's this long, drawn-out comparison or argument between the merits of the different cosmological schemes. And not only that, is it making a beep every time I'd go to the next slide? Oh, all right, well, I apologize for the beeps. But we do sort of have to have the volume up for later. Anyway, he mentions Galileo here by name, the glass of Galileo, a reference to Galileo's telescope, and he mentions Galileo on two other occasions as well. And he's said to have met Galileo near the end of Galileo's life. Just so there's no confusion on this, it's not like he was name-dropping and listing all sorts of famous people. This is actually the only sort of living person that that Milton refers to by name in Paradise Lost. We can look at John Donne, who's almost a contemporary-ish of Shakespeare. He was born, I guess, 8 years, something like that, after Shakespeare. And in one of his poems, he's very much sort of taken aback by the so-called new philosophy. In fact, he gives us this term. So did the world from the first hour decay, that evening was beginning of the day, and new philosophy calls all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost, and the earth, and no man's wit can well direct him where to look for it. So he's really feeling quite discombobulated by the new philosophy. But you have to remember, this some time has gone by, right? He's writing a year after Galileo's Sidereus Nuncius, so this is sort of a later stage in the development. So we're looking at Shakespeare. So Shakespeare's a little bit earlier. And the tricky thing is that you don't find overt sort of engagement with the new philosophy. He doesn't sort of address it head on like the writers that I just mentioned. But having said that, there's all kinds of astronomy and astrology in Shakespeare's works. He's always talking about the stars, the heavens, you know, what's going on in the heavens, the quote, spheres, which everybody imagined was carrying the celestial objects, the sun, the moon, you know, sunrises, sunsets, eclipses, those are mentioned several times, for example, in King Lear, meteors and comets, although in the last two cases not necessarily meaning exactly what we mean by those terms, but nonetheless, they're there a lot. And I'm going to show the first video clip. Hopefully this will work. And this is using astronomy as a metaphor. Let's see if it works. All right. So a couple of things here. First of all, somebody has to take their blood pressure medication, I think. I'm not going to actually try to summarize the plots of the different plays. I will a little bit when I get to Cymbeline, because Cymbeline is a more obscure play, but hopefully everybody had some encounter in high school or university with Julius Caesar. That scene actually, well, let's just say it doesn't go well for Caesar. The next 60 seconds or so are not good for Caesar. We are going to stick with that play, though, for just a moment. I'm going to back it up to an earlier scene. So I guess the other thing to say about the clip we just saw is that, of course, he's engaging with astronomy, but it's sort of astronomy 101, right? So we all sort of know, that is to say, you don't have to be a professional astronomer to know that everything appears to rotate around what we would call Polaris, or the North Star, or as Shakespeare puts it, the Pole Star. And you know, when you pick up a scholarly edition, I've got a Cymbeline and a Hamlet here, I don't have a Julius Caesar, sometimes the footnotes are helpful. Sometimes they're more helpful than others, though. Sometimes all they say is, oh, well, you know, the Pole Star is the Northern Star. So, I mean, that's great. And its use as a metaphor is fine. But in terms of distinguishing between the Ptolemaic version of the cosmos or the Copernican, it's sort of irrelevant, right? So there's nothing in that scene that gives us Shakespeare's vote one way or the other. Now, here's a scene that is perhaps gives us a little bit more to discuss. So this is earlier. They're meeting to plot. I'm going to pause it for a moment because I just want to sort of fill in some backstory. So it's the middle of the night, right? They're getting together in Brutus's garden. They've come there secretly to plot a dastardly act. Now, I've paused it here because we can play. Of course, some of you know the play, so you're excused from this, but for those who don't, you can ask yourself, well, I wonder what's going to happen, what they're going to talk about next. Are they going to talk about the future of Rome? Are they going to talk about when is murder justified? No. All right. Yes, why not? Let's talk about the position of the rising sun. I mean, I do that a lot, but then I'm not planning to kill anyone tomorrow. All right, so it's a bit funny. The scholarly editions don't have a lot to say about what that scene is about. But we can talk about it. It's interesting because I'm trying to figure out if it's sort of wrong or only wrong-ish. I think in the end it's only wrong-ish, and it doesn't even have to be that, because remember, Shakespeare doesn't have to hold the opinions that his characters hold. But this is the critical line. Here's I point my sword, blah, 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 which is a great way going on the south wing, the youthful season of the year, making it sound like it's still late winter, or winter or late winter or early spring. But what month is it actually?
March.
Yeah. When in March? Yeah. Right, exactly. In other words, it's almost the equinox, and if it was the equinox, the sun would rise there. It looks so much better from Florida than it does from Toronto or from Rome. But anyway, so it would be, let's see, it would be just a little bit over here, wouldn't it? But he says, a great way growing on the south? Like, I don't know what, as if it's somewhere over here, but that's wrong. But I mean, of course, I guess he's allowed to be wrong. There's actually another problem, which you wouldn't know from this snippet, from the clip that we saw, because it's mentioned a little bit earlier. But it's 3 o'clock, that's mentioned a little bit earlier. So it's actually too early for the dawn's early light to be visible at any time of year. So that's weird, right? That's a little bit odd. But anyway, I'm not putting this up here to say Shakespeare was ignorant. Sort of the opposite. I mean, he seems to have been somewhat fascinated by the comings and goings of celestial objects. So at the very least, it gives us something to think about. And I mean, obviously it serves some, dramatic or narrative function, and that's probably the larger part of the reason why it's there. I was talking to one of my colleagues at the Institute yesterday who said, let's also remember the astrological significance of the scene, because, if Casca is off, or if the other characters are off by that much, it actually puts the sun in the next constellation, or more likely two constellations over. So it could have astrological overtones. You know what I mean? Like maybe tomorrow is not the best day to kill a political figure. So I hadn't thought of that, but that's an interesting idea. I'm going to talk about another very interesting scene that sort of involves celestial matters in Hamlet, and I think this one will have a bit more of a payoff for us. It's the famous opening scene. So the guards are on the battlements of Elsinore. A ghost has appeared for the last couple of nights. Horatio comes along, and he's a bit skeptical, and he asks, well, so when was this happening? So Bernardo says, well, last night of all, when yon same star that's westward from the pole had made his course to that part of heaven where it now burns, to illume that part of heaven where now burns Marcellus and myself, the bell then beating one. Well, he doesn't get to finish the sentence because, speak of the devil, the ghost himself appears right at that moment. The critical line is this one, yon same star that's westward from the pole. What star are we talking about? We know what time it is because that's so. To figure this out, we need two things, two data points, right? We need to know what time of year and what time of night, right? Because once we know that, we get our planisphere for $10 from the planetarium. Oh wait, we don't have a planetarium. Well, anyway, you go to the place where they sell these, and for $10, or you get it on Amazon, and you just line up the date with the time. And these, by the way, are like the best invention ever. And then you can figure it out. So what do we know? We know it's about 1 a.m. because the bell then beating 1, so that's given to us. We know the time of year roughly. Now, I can sort of talk you through that, but I have to make it fast so we don't run out of time. But and this is maybe a little bit controversial, so you don't have to agree with it. But there's some broad agreement that the murder had to have happened in September because we know 2 months have passed, and now it's a very crisp, cold. They say it, right? It's in the dialogue, it's very cold, and, 'tis bitter cold. But on the other hand, old King Hamlet was murdered while he was taking a nap outdoors in his garden. So anyway, you put it all together and you figure outdoors, taking a nap, 2 months later, really cold out, there's a case to be made for November. We also know it's not Christmas time because of other bits of dialogue. All right, some guesses have been put forward. Here the footnotes do have a bit more to say, but again, so it depends which, you know, if you get a cheaper or more expensive edition and how good or informative the footnotes are. I mean, they're usually pretty good. But again, some of them just have the very minimal one that say, oh, pole, that means the pole star. All right, that's, you know, that's good. So one guy guesses that it's a planet. I'll have more to say about that in a minute. Harold Jenkins, who is, you know, brilliant, his edition of Hamlet is, you know, students, you're going to see them all over campus reading his edition of Hamlet, and his footnotes are awesome, but he says that maybe the star is Capella. Well, let's think about that. So, since you can't see the planisphere, I'm just going to talk about, here I've put up a picture of what it would show, right? So this would have been the whole sky, but obviously I've cropped it off, so we're just going to look at the part that's of interest to us. Well, here's the pole, right? Everybody's cool with that? I know from the back of the auditorium you might not be able to read the names of the stars and constellations, but don't worry about it. So this is Polaris, right? This is the North Star, or as Shakespeare calls it, the pole. The overhead point would be the center of this large, right? This is the horizon. So the overhead point is around here in the constellation of Auriga, the charioteer. Well, there's Capella. Look, Capella is the brightest star in Auriga. It's almost overhead. Now, granted, you know, a half hour later it'll be here, and a half hour earlier it was here, but basically it's very close to being overhead. So here's the pole. Would you talk about something that's overhead as being westward from the pole? I don't think so. Westward from the pole would seem to mean somewhere around here, but not too far, because if you go over here, you wouldn't use that sort of language. You would say in the west or in the southwest or something like that, right? If someone was asking you where the University of Toronto was, you wouldn't say, well, it's east of Hamilton, right? I mean, it's true, but you wouldn't say it that way. You'd think of a closer landmark. Okay, so we're looking in this area. Well, there's the constellation of Cassiopeia. You'll recognize the familiar W, or M if you're looking at it from the other side. So it's one of those beginner's constellations that probably everybody learned. But the only thing is it has five bright, I mean, they're not very bright. The stars go, you know, first magnitude, second, third, fourth. And the stars in Cassiopeia are all second magnitude, and they're all about the same brightness as each other. So if Cassiopeia had one really bright star in the way that Auriga has one really bright star, you might say that same star that was there yesterday at the same time. But if it's a group of five stars, you'd probably just say Cassiopeia. So Cassiopeia by itself doesn't seem to give us the answer, but it's in the right part of the sky. But those two guesses, I've said why Capella is probably not a very good guess. And a planet? Well, most of you have taken your Astronomy 101, and some of you teach it. So a planet has to be on the ecliptic. That's the dotted line here. That's the projection of the Earth's orbit around the sun into the imagined celestial sphere. So the closest a planet could be to the pole would be here, which is not, that's not westward from the pole. That's high in the southwest. It's crazy, right? And I mean, this angle would be, what, about 60 degrees or something? I mean, it's an enormous swath of sky. So doesn't look like planet or Capella are very good guesses. Now, I'm not the one who reasoned through this. This is an article. I'll give you the reference in a second. But so there's nothing in Cassiopeia today that seems to do the trick. But there was, at one time, a bright star in Cassiopeia. I know some of you are ahead of me on this and on the next slide. So this is, I mentioned Tycho Brahe very briefly earlier. So this was what we now call Tycho's star, right? This was the supernova. They didn't know it was a supernova, but they called it a new star, marked in Latin as Nova Stella. Here it is. So here's the familiar W. I have to stand over here so I can see it. Here's the familiar W of Cassiopeia, and here's a star that isn't supposed to be there, but burst into the sky in the late fall of 1572. Now, and that's from this theory is by Donald Olson, who some of you may have read some of his articles. He does this sort of forensic astronomy, which is pretty awesome. He looks at old paintings, like, for example, a few years ago, he looked at Edvard Munch's The Scream and tried to figure out where and when it was painted, like to the minute. And it, I mean, it's like really, I don't know how close he got on that one, but he's written a whole series of these articles. They're very cool. But here's the point, or well, the first part of the point is, you've probably got your calculators out, and you're taking 1572 and you're subtracting 1564, the year of Shakespeare's birth, to figure out how old he was at this time. And the first time I did it, I did the math wrong, and I got 18. And I thought, oh, that's awesome, he was a teenager. No, he was 8. He was an 8-year-old child. So it may not have made the biggest impression on him, but remember, he was already in grammar school. The star was there for a whole year, And also, people were talking and writing about it. And as, Tycho Brahe was the one who, it ended up sort of being named after him, but it was also observed by Thomas Diggs in England and various other people all across Europe. But also, it was mentioned in Holinshed's Chronicles some years later in two different editions. So by this time, Shakespeare was getting towards being an adult and working on his plays, at least by the time of the second edition. And we know that Shakespeare loved Holinshed's Chronicles because he's always plagiarizing little bits of it for his history plays and stuff like that. Sorry, using as a source, as he does with Montaigne and others. I'm not passing judgment, but it is funny that we expel students for plagiarism, but it was sort of like the way to do things back then. I'm not passing judgment on anything. So this is meant to strengthen the argument that maybe Shakespeare was inspired by Tycho's star and then decided to use it as a plot device. But that's fine, and we can maybe assess that theory on its own merits, and we can also talk about what connection Shakespeare may have had or not had with different scientific figures of his time. So Tycho Brahe, the guy who observed the supernova, no direct connection that we know of, but as I go on, we'll see if there was maybe a sort of a connection kind of lurking in the background. Also, maybe a connection through a middleman, Thomas Diggs, who I've mentioned briefly, he observed the supernova. That picture, of course, is a travesty, but he didn't have time to get a selfie painted. So we're stuck. No, but a better thing to look at than that embarrassing stick figure is his diagram. His very, well, to us, to people who sort of love history of science, his famous diagram supporting the Copernican solar system. This is the first. So his father, Leonard Diggs, who was a surveyor and mathematician, had put out an almanac sort of explaining stuff about the sky. Thomas Diggs later puts out an updated edition of his father's almanac, I guess perhaps best known to me anyway, for this diagram, which is, you know, here's the Copernican system, and here are the stars. You know, so Copernicus never did this part. Imagining the stars going out not in one single sphere, but going out basically forever. So that's a very bold idea. This is the first popularization, if I can use that word, of the Copernican theory in English. So whether Shakespeare saw it, we can't say for sure, but there's more to be said about this this connection to Thomas Diggs. Thomas Diggs had two children. One of them was a poet, Leonard Diggs. Now, why am I showing yet another picture of Shakespeare? Well, this is the first folio. But Leonard Diggs was a poet, sort of an amateur poet. He wouldn't be remembered, I don't think, for anything, except that this is the frontispiece of the first folio. If you flip a few more pages, you find, so there's a little poem by Ben Jonson here, but if you flip a few more pages, you've got a little poem by Leonard Diggs. Leonard Diggs was a fan of Shakespeare, and he wrote a little poem saying how great Shakespeare was. Now, by this time, Shakespeare was dead, because this is the first folio of 1623, but clearly they had some connection. Whether Shakespeare could have met Thomas Diggs, well, Thomas Diggs dies in 1595, so Shakespeare was still very early in his career. We don't know for sure they met, but the widow and the two children continued to live in that neighborhood where, by the way, Shakespeare also lived. And again, I'll mention I'm not the one who figured this out. This is in Leslie Hodgson's book that was published in the 1930s and a newer book by, his last name is Nicol, also explores this. This is London as it looked back then. If you have a time machine, I recommend going back and buying some real estate anywhere on this map. That's what I would do. I'm going to zoom in on this area. I'm going to zoom in on this area. Here's St. Paul's Cathedral. Here's Smithfield. Moorgate is over here. So let's just take a closer look. Where they actually lived, again, here's the cathedral. This was the Gothic version of the cathedral. This is before Christopher Wren built the version that we see today. It was actually bigger. These are the various ancient gates to the walled city of London. By this point, of course, urban sprawl was a thing, right? So the city is spilling out over its walls. This is Cripplegate. And they lived, Shakespeare was moving around a lot, so it's not like he was always in this neighborhood. But for a couple of years, he did live, right here. There it is, Monkwell, or Mugwell. The name would change, and Silver Street. These streets don't actually exist anymore. Some of them do. Noble Street is still there. Cheapside, Newgate, these are still there. What I'm about to show you next is a photograph from a year and a half ago of that intersection. Be prepared to be extremely disappointed. Yeah. if Shakespeare's ghost is there, I don't know. However, it's not all isn't lost, because a couple of blocks away there is a little monument to Shakespeare. It's actually a tribute not only to Shakespeare, but to the First Folio, this book published in 1623, and the two men, primarily, two of his actor buddies, who oversaw the publication, John Hemmings and Henry Condell. And Hemmings also lived in the neighborhood, so there's a good reason to imagine that, for a while anyway, this actually was where Shakespeare hung out. I mean, he would have gone to church there, and this was his local hood. So going back to our sort of who knew who thing, there's some kind of a connection, I think one can make the case, between Shakespeare and the Diggs family. And there's a connection here, because Tycho Brahe and Thomas Diggs corresponded. This doesn't directly link Shakespeare to Tycho Brahe, but hey, you know, it's better than nothing. And now I'm going to talk about Tycho Brahe some more, and I apologize if I'm speaking a little bit quickly. So Tycho was the greatest of the pre-telescopic observers, right? He had various sophisticated instruments, but this is before Galileo. And he was a nobleman, and the king liked what he was doing and said, I'm going to give you your own island to do your research as you will. And the income earned by the peasants, you get that money. It's a good deal. Here's the island today. It's in the channel separating present-day Denmark and Sweden, although at the time it was all part of the Danish kingdom. He built this very grand observatory. It sadly doesn't exist anymore. It was called Uraniborg, and it was a big deal. And it was famous enough that King James came to visit there at a certain point. He wasn't yet King of England, but while he was still King of Scotland, he visited the place. So did some actors from Shakespeare's acting company. There's no reason to believe that Shakespeare himself went there, but some of Shakespeare's friends went there to perform. So again, we have sort of a loose connection. Here's the setting. This is a map published in Tycho Brahe's lifetime. The island, Vian, is marked here, and in Latin, the name of the observatory, Uraniborg. So this is Tycho Brahe's island. And then if we just zoom in, actually only zooming in a little bit, well, there's a sea battle going on, that's fine. And there's a castle. It's Kronborg Castle, but it's adjacent to Helsinore. I can't quite pronounce it the Danish way, but in English, Elsinore. So this isn't just any old castle. This is, you guessed it, this is the setting that Shakespeare chose for his play. Hamlet. He could have picked some other place. Hamlet has medieval sources, but the medieval sources just say Denmark. It's Shakespeare who decides to put it at Elsinore. A few more thoughts about this. This is a partial list of the cast of characters of Hamlet, and we see a bunch of names, and Hamlet's a very famous play, so these are all familiar, well, maybe the first few anyway, are quite familiar names, and they're mostly sort of classical, sort of ordinary-sounding names. But two of them stand out. Except the way this is, the projector here doesn't do yellows very well, but I've tried to highlight Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who do have very stereotypically Danish-sounding names. They actually sound even more Danish than actual Danish names. But that's fine. Is there anything else to be said about this? Well, yes, there is, and I'm going to mention Tycho Brahe again. Tycho Brahe put out sort of a collection of his astronomical letters and mailed it to colleagues across Europe, including colleagues in England. Not only that, he actually mentions Thomas Diggs. He says I forget the exact words, but the most honorable, clever mathematician, Thomas Diggs, something like that. And to stick with it, he wants a portrait of himself. I think he sort of is a little bit full of himself, is probably the way I would phrase it. He's sort of a pompous dude. He lost part of his nose in a duel. Some of you know the story. But at any rate, he gets a portrait commissioned by, it's a copperplate engraving done in Amsterdam. He includes that with the letters, and it gets mailed out to different people, including at least two Englishmen, actually, that we know of. And if you look at, these are the names around the outer perimeter of members of his extended family. And sure enough, there's Rosencrantz, and there's Guildenstern. The people who haven't seen this before sort of gasp a little bit, and the people who have seen it before go, okay, that's cool. This seems to get rediscovered every 30 years or so. It's not a secret. And I think the first person who wrote about it was in the 1930s, but it might even have been the 19th century. And then, like, basically nobody talks about it for 30 years, and then somebody decides to talk about it again. So this, again, makes us ask if there was, a bit more of a reason to think that Shakespeare had an awareness of what's going on. There are different ways he could have come across that engraving. He could have actually seen Tycho Brahe's writings, but the other thing is he might have just been at the Diggs household, and this is the tricky part of the story, but it's quite possible that even after Thomas Diggs has died, like, we've got the widow, who's quite wealthy, this is one of the bigger houses in the neighborhood, and we've got the two sons. Are they just going to throw out or sell off the father's possessions, including maybe his most treasured correspondences with his Danish friends? I mean, maybe Shakespeare saw the engraving at Thomas Diggs's house. But who knows? It's just an idea. I'm going to talk about another interesting little moment in Hamlet that will again bring us to Thomas Diggs, potentially. In a scene in somewhere towards the middle of the play, Hamlet says, act two, I guess, they're talking about whether, just how horrible Denmark is, and Hamlet says, oh, it's like a prison. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern say, no, we like it here. We like it here. We don't think it's a prison at all. And Hamlet says, why then 'tis none for you, for there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me it's a prison. And Rosencrantz says, why then your ambition makes it one, 'tis too narrow for your mind. And again, those of you who know the play know what's coming up. Oh God, I could be bound in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space, were it not that I have bad dreams. I don't have anything to say about the bad dreams, but the king of infinite space is an interesting line. It's quite unusual. Shakespeare doesn't use the word infinite very many times, and when he does, he's not generally talking about spatial extent. So this is a line that kind of stands out in the play, and maybe one could argue, and a small handful of scholars argue, that this is inspired by Thomas Diggs's diagram of infinite space. And it even says it's infinitely extendeth-ing for people who don't get the message originally. So maybe there's something going on here. I've tried to sort of make the case for Shakespeare having some consciousness of these new developments in astronomy. There is still a bit of a problem in terms of the timeline of events, because, yes, Copernicus published in 1543, but you can always say, well, so what? Nobody read it, nobody cared, it was very highly technical, very mathematical, blah, blah, blah. Word really didn't start to get out till the time of Galileo, who looks through a telescope in 1609, and then in the fall of 16, and then in the spring of 1610, publishes his book, the very famous little pamphlet about his discoveries, the Sidereus Nuncius, the starry messenger, with these engravings of the moon looking perhaps a little bit like the Death Star, a little bit more like the Death Star than you might want it to. But these are his original drawings, which you can see in the museum in Florence, and they're much more accurate. They're actually quite vivid. Of course, he didn't just look at the moon. He discovered that the Milky Way was made up of countless faint stars, and that Jupiter isn't just Jupiter. Jupiter seems to have these four. I mean, at first he didn't know, is there two, is there three? Pretty soon he figures it out that there's four. This is his observing law going day by day, right? So eventually he figures out that there's four little objects. Today we call them the Galilean moons. Four moons that nobody knew about orbiting Jupiter. That's fine, but again, it comes pretty late. And the usual argument is, well, this can't be very relevant to Shakespeare's career. But remember, Shakespeare has not quite thrown in the towel yet. He still has to write, you always have to word this carefully. Shakespeare did say, well, I better write three romances before I move back to Stratford. Right. But anyway, he wrote three romances, and then he moved back to Stratford. The Tempest, Winter's Tale, and Cymbeline. And if we're going to talk about the Galileo connection, the one to focus on is Cymbeline. I had the privilege of seeing it at the Stratford Festival 2 years ago. Maybe some of you did. It doesn't get performed very often, and there's kind of a reason for that. It's a weird, complicated play. It's set in ancient Britain. It's set at the time of the birth of Christ, although that actually isn't mentioned in the play. There are King Cymbeline is trying to maintain order while the Roman army is threatening to invade, and his two long-lost sons are being raised in the forest by a guy who is living as an outlaw, and his daughter, heaven forbid, has married a commoner named Posthumus Leonatus, the hero of the play. The king banishes Posthumus, he flees to Rome. There's more, there's cross-dressing, there's mistaken identity, there's a couple of murders. But the part that's relevant to us is, comes near the end. This is Michael Pennington as Posthumus in the BBC's production. He's, at a certain point, pretending to be a Roman to get himself captured by the British because he wants to die. He does get captured, they throw him in jail. He falls into a kind of a trance or a dream, and four ghostly figures appear. The stage directions, these are the ghosts of his four dead family members, people he actually didn't know in life, his mother, his father, his two brothers. The stage direction says they circle him round as he lies sleeping. Now, he's experiencing a great deal of anguish. The ghosts are offering him support. They turn up to the sky and appeal to the god Jupiter for help. First, it's the brothers who speak up, "Help, Jupiter, or we appeal, and from thy justice fly." Well, in the canon of Shakespeare's plays, people are often calling out to the gods for help. Usually the gods don't answer back, but in Cymbeline, Jupiter obliges. Jupiter descends in thunder and lightning, sitting upon an eagle. This is quite a production. And they pulled it off at Stratford, and it was probably performed not outdoors at the Globe Theater, but indoors at the Blackfriars Theater in London, where you could do this fancy stagecraft. Jupiter throws a thunderbolt, the ghosts fall on their knees. And Jupiter is upset, he starts to chastise the ghosts. "No more, you petty spirits of region low." Region low, right, in the Aristotelian sense, maybe of the heavenly realm and the earthly realm. You know, "Don't offend our hearing." He's basically telling the ghosts, like, "Knock it off. You're bothering important people like me." All right, so what is going on here? This is different from a normal Shakespeare play. Jupiter descends from the heavens, four ghosts appear and move in a circle. Well, the argument goes, by a very small number of people who are interested in this, that maybe this is an allusion to four newly discovered worlds circling around not the Roman god Jupiter, but the planet Jupiter, published 3 or 4 or 5 months before Shakespeare writes Cymbeline. Again, these are the three people that I know of who have written on this. Because we're pressed for time, I won't say too much more about that, but John Pitcher is at Oxford and actually writes about it. And if you get the Penguin edition, he has a nice little thing on it. But it's not like, "Oh, everybody should be talking about this." I mean, that's how I feel, like, everybody should be talking about this. But, like, yeah, so 3 or 4 or 5 people are talking about this. That's the Penguin edition. I'm talking quickly because I do want to squeeze in this business of King Lear and the sort of very dark, possibly modern, one might argue, vision of the universe. In the original quarto edition, it's so hard to even see. I mean, you barely see King Lear, but here it is. It's right. It's the true chronicle history of the life and death of King Lear and his three daughters, with the unfortunate life of Edgar, son to the heir, Earl of Gloucester, and his blah blah blah. The other, the human assumed humor of Tom of Bedlam, S performed by so and so. It keeps on going. But here in the folio, it's a little more concise. But this is the one that was published by Shakespeare's friends in 1623. Shakespeare was already dead by the time the folio is put out. And you'll recognize Combe Fior in the current. I guess they're probably in rehearsals at the moment, but this is for this year's Stratford season. It's a very dark play. Bad things happen. Not only bad things happen to good people. And one of the topics that sort of haunts the play, I mean, they're sort of debating what sort of a world do we live in. What is nature? What is the nature of nature, if we can put it that way? I mentioned near the beginning that there were these astrological views, magical views, and something I didn't mention because it's a whole big topic, but this microcosm-macrocosm connection, sort of imagining that everything in the cosmos is sort of causally linked to everything else. So things that happen in the heavens are terribly important for terrestrial affairs, for family politics, for national politics, the fate of the nation, and so on. And this comes up in the last of the clips that I'll show, and here it's a conversation between Gloucester and his illegitimate son Edmund, who are going to express very different views about eclipses. And I don't know if it's important, but scholars do suggest that maybe this was inspired by actual solar and lunar eclipses that happened in the fall of 1605, I think I've got the year right, when Shakespeare was putting the finishing touches on on King Lear. Now, I've trimmed it just a little bit because Gloucester goes on and on, basically saying the universe is going to the dogs, and we're going to the dogs, and it's the universe's fault. Yeah. So, first of all, yeah, so that's the coolest thing, right, in Shakespeare, isn't it? I've always loved that that scene from the BBC production there. And it does bring up, you know, so clearly Gloucester and his illegitimate son, Edmund, have very different ways of thinking about this issue. You know, should we blame our misfortune on the heavens or not? And, I mean, something that I don't have time to get into it, check out the book, but it is funny that Shakespeare's villains seem to have this kind of scientific mindset. I don't quite know, what conclusion we should draw from that, but it's quite interesting. Now, I've talked about how dark a play this is. In Cymbeline, they cry out for the gods, and in that one case, Jupiter comes down and helps a little bit. He doesn't do a lot. He comes down, gives them a book. It doesn't really matter. But in King Lear, there's a lot of appealing to the gods, and they do nothing, right? And you know, Stephen Greenblatt and others who comment on King Lear have, you know, sort of acknowledged this this lack of, you know, the gods aren't doing much to help. That's Greg Hicks in the Royal Shakespeare production from a few years ago. So what does it mean? What does it mean about Shakespeare's worldview? Again, so there's a lot of issues here. There's accidentally confusing Shakespeare with his dramatic creation, so we don't know that he agrees with Edmund and disagrees with Gloucester, but on the other hand, he can't be unaware of the fact that some people are just mocking this kind of astrology BS, right? Because he's got it coming out of Edmund's mouth, so Shakespeare has to be at least aware that there are alternate ways of looking at this microcosm-macrocosm connection. So, is he sort of a hard-nosed rationalist? You know, is he? That's good. I thought maybe the young folks might not recognize Carl Sagan, but that's good. Everybody recognizes Carl. Could have used Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, so of course, I don't want to overstate this. I'm not putting forward some kind of an argument that Shakespeare was the Carl Sagan of the Elizabethan age, because that would be crazy. Similarly, you can ask, you know, if he's rejecting all kinds of superstition, then perhaps he's some kind of a, you know, proto-atheist or something. Again, these are very loaded words because atheism, the way we think of it today, again, would have been quite alien at that time. But having said that, the word does crop up, always derogatory, right? It's sort of like, nobody ever says, I'm an atheist. They say, you're an atheist, right? It's like, you're a bad driver. Nobody ever says it about themselves. And it's used as a put down, and it's kind of synonymous with dangerous, criminal, untrustworthy. Maybe that hasn't changed that much, I don't know. But that's certainly the sense in which it was used. And Shakespeare's colleague Christopher Marlowe faced public accusations of atheism. For Shakespeare, we don't know. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with Shakespeare not, I think, as a medieval figure, just buying wholeheartedly into these various superstitious views of a soul-infused cosmos. But he's also not a hardcore rationalist scientist, as we might use the term today. In fact, I think the only safe place to put him is in this transition zone in the middle, but so much the better. I think that's part of what makes reading Shakespeare such a rich and rewarding experience. And I'm going to wrap it up. There's too many people that, you know, people that I interviewed, people that I emailed to get help on a number of things, too many to list, but those are some of the people at the center of this without whom I couldn't have written this book. If you like listening to the CBC, and I hope we all do, tune in on the 14th. Apology, it's Passover, so I apologize for those who are in the middle of Seder meal, but they'll repeat it or you can catch the podcast. And that's it. Thank you very much.